This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 12, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, burlesque dancer and instructor Lola Frost, as well as a trialogue with Buto dancer and occultist Alcistis Demek. Joining me this week as co-host is fashion designer Misty Greer. On this week's episode, both guests provide valuable insight into the world of physical performance art, specifically the language of dance. While each guest's particular style differs from one another, the motivation to self-actualize is present in each of their work. Also, through their own particular praxes, both seem able to access the unconscious in fascinating and powerful ways. It seems reasonable to state that the utility of any art form, scientific methodology, or occult practice can be measured in the positive effects it evokes in one's life. And the positivity that my guests exude and bring into other people's lives is obvious. So, thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. Joining me today on Pentimental is Lola Frost. Lola is an internationally recognized burlesque performer as well as co-director of the Vancouver Burlesque Center. She's headlined several festivals over the years and competes annually at the Burlesque Hall of Fame in several categories, including the Queen of Burlesque Miss Exotic World category, where in 2013 she was awarded second runner-up. So with that said, Lola, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, John. It's a total pleasure to be with you.
So starting off, can you give us a few more details about your background, specifically what drew you into the world of competitive dancing and what was it about burlesque in particular that drew you in?
Well, I've always been a dancer and like a self-identified dancer, but never was classically trained. I just kind of started making it up in my own living room, and actually went into figure skating before I entered dance. And through figure skating, of course, you do competitions and you have training through dance. So that was my youth up until about grade 10. And then I went more the theater direction and loved being part of the weirdo art kids at school. And I kind of didn't dance for a little while until I discovered raves, which were fantastic. And that sort of got me back into like the feeling of music embodying my entire being. And that was really inspirational to me and sort of became a professional go-go dancer. I would get hired to do parties and clubs and venues just to dance. And that was really rewarding. But I've known since I was quite young that I wanted to be a stripper. I just wanted to take my costumes off and I wanted to striptease and I wanted to embody my feminine power and really like being on stage. So I knew there had to be an outlet for that. And I knew the word burlesque and I knew that it would be out there for me somewhere, but I didn't know where. And I started to see flyers similar to how you would look for underground parties about these shows going on. And so when I eventually went to one, everything really made sense. It was like, yes, this is exactly what I want to do. And so I asked a producer how one may get into that. And he was like, oh yeah, kid, we'll give you a shot. It didn't sound quite like that, but it felt like that, kind of carny. And I don't know, he hired me for a show. I did two numbers and I just kept getting booked. So the competitive portion of that didn't happen for a long time because the competition component is not huge in burlesque. We have a lot of festivals and a lot of showcases where people, the communities can come together in different cities. You can fly to different cities and be part of these communities and big showcases. And sometimes they have competitions, but it is rare. I don't compete in a ton of places. I only compete at the Hall of Fame because it's sort of the biggest one. And I do believe healthy competition elevates art, elevates anything. Without it being the only thing that you're after. It's not a pageant culture. It's a display of beautiful sort of the sort of echelon of your art form. And the Hall of Fame is unique that way because it is a reunion of all of our legends. So whomever is still alive and performing, they gather together at the Hall of Fame, these women that are between 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. And they either do a walk of fame or they'll perform. And we go there to honor them. And in that, we have a competition to crown a queen who represents your community worldwide every year.
Can you give us a little perspective on the history of burlesque? Where did it come from? And so on and so forth.
Yeah, I'll give you the Coles notes. Well, I'll give you the intro to burlesque, where in the late 1800s in Europe, Lydia Thompson was a performer and it kind of came from vaudeville, the word vaudeville, and burlesque was the embodiment of all the components that happened at a burlesque show, which was comedy, variety, slapstick, anything you can kind of put on a stage that was interesting and lowbrow. And these people made fun of the upper society. Burlesque in itself means to make laugh. And when she brought her troupe of women over to America to do some touring, they often, you know, they parodied not only high society, but they dressed as boys, they wore pants, and it was quite sensational, as you can imagine, in that time. A lot of it came out of New York. So once burlesque kind of took off, New York had its biggest sort of components of it because there were so many people there. There was Broadway, and they started opening burlesque houses, Minsky's Burlesque. And again, it was classically more lowbrow, although lots of people went. And the stripteasers, the strippers, now called burlesque dancers, were just part of that show until, you know, later on, so 20s, 30s, 40s, up into 50s and 60s, the shows start to get less about variety and more about the girls. As you can imagine, during the war and even post-war, that kind of entertainment was a little bit vital to keeping our troops entertained and engaged. And once the entertainment value, the kind of family value of variety left, it changed to a more male dominated audience as opposed to men and women going together. So up in the 60s and 70s, although the feature dancers in more of a sort of strip club sort of style, it was less burlesque and a little bit more exotic dance at that point. and they still did really interesting artistic acts as feature dancers, but because the element of high art value, even in a lowbrow art form, was a little bit disconnected, anyone can just get naked. So the reflection and sort of focus on the integrity of the striptease was a little bit lost. And the resurgence didn't really happen until the early mid 90s, where, you know, a bunch of girls got wind of this thing called burlesque. And if you're familiar with the term riot girl, I always associate the term a bunch of riot girls discovered burlesque and started the neo burlesque movement. And that happened in LA and New York predominantly first, you know, because they're kind of on the edge of being able to see this thing happen. Of course, there's pockets everywhere because collective consciousness. Once someone gets wind of that. And so that's now what we do. We do neo burlesque, which is new burlesque, honoring the women who paved the way and were scandalous, amazing creatures who had financial freedom and toured around the world doing this striptease. And we make it into something modern and political, artistic, spiritual, sort of whatever it is that we want to express. And primarily they are called burlesque shows now because there is still a focus on mostly the act of striptease, although variety and vaudeville are coming back to be part of these shows more and more, which makes it pretty fabulous.
So the impression I had for a long time of the burlesque dancer was just the woman on stage with the giant ostrich feathers.
Of course.
But as you're alluding to, there's a wide spectrum of performances. And can you give us maybe some idea of what neo-burlesque would entail, like a standard performance, if there's such a thing?
Yeah, standard, no, but maybe an overview for sure. When I say sort of classic versus neo, people who perform classic burlesque, even now, they're pastiching our grandmothers, our legends. And they use the traditional bump and grind, you know, the shimmies, the shakes, the panel skirts, a very high aesthetic to what they did in the golden age of burlesque. A neo performer is someone who takes modern music, modern movement, and sort of can weave concepts to express things that are deeper than just striptease. So, you know, you're not up there just to go from clothed to, you know, mostly naked, you are sort of using it as a platform to express something. So some of our grandmothers, like Dirty Martini, the living legends who were the first of the neo performers, Juliette this Muse, are pioneers to use things to speak out against politics in America, or, you know, making fun of maybe an art movement that is happening right now. We kind of need to have a place to express that. So although there still involves striptease, it's not in a way that's meant to be a wink and a giggle and a wiggle. It's meant to be more in your face or thought provoking. So to me, that's sort of what neo-burlesque is meant to embody. And it can look like anything from being, you know, tied up in a straitjacket to using other elements to dump all over yourself, or pulling an American flag out of your asshole. That's definitely happened. So the sky's the limit. And what I've always loved and admired about burlesque dancers is that you can use it as a platform for any training you have, any artistic outlook you have, and you put it on this stage. And something about the removal, or maybe even the reverse removal, so starting naked and putting on, is the only kind of element that you need to combine with every other art you do. So that's why I love neo-burlesque. It's not a formula, and it's not standard.
Now, is there any sort of crossover between, I guess, what most people consider exotic dancing or stripping or burlesque? Do women go in between those worlds? Are they kind of compartmentalized? What is your view on that?
Yeah, absolutely. They're cousins, not sisters. So people do, of course, float between the burlesque stage and the exotic dance stage. Not everyone does. The difference primarily is very simply audience. When you visit an exotic dance club, it is a sales environment, and it is also a environment where you don't have to watch what's going on stage. You can merely be a part of the environment and sales. Whereas a burlesque show, you go and you pay a ticketed price. You engage with the performer. They engage with you. So the fourth wall is not there. You know, we kind of reach through and we smash it. Whereas an exotic dance stage can be a fourth wall. The dancer doesn't have to engage with you per se. She can go up there and just do whatever. And the customers don't have to either. So that is, like, in a nutshell, the difference between the two sort of things, but they are definitely connected. Like I say, in the classic burlesque days, they were called strippers and it was exotic dance what they were doing. But of course, the stigma and connotations of what modern strip clubs are really gets put into the face of the media that it's like bad, wrong, dirty, you know, sex work. And of course, nothing can be valuable. And one of the biggest things, like, I consider them my sisters. You know, I've crossed platforms, lots of my friends cross platforms, because art, as we all know, does not always pay the bills. If you have a skill, you know, use it wherever you can. And I just really don't agree with people coming up to me and they're like, oh, I just love what you do. It's so classy and artistic. Not like those strippers. I just take the time to gently educate them about what they're saying and how horrible it is and how you don't have to degrade someone else's life choices and their survival tactics or their job to bring me up. You know, I've seen some highly artistic exotic dancers and some real bad, unclassy burlesque dancers. So I believe that the word classy is classist and you are, you know, putting someone down if you use that label. So each to their own. You don't have to like exotic dancers or exotic dance clubs, but what they do is absolutely equally as valuable as what burlesque dancers do.
Hmm. So a friend of mine, he makes quite a few videos and he considers what he does a form of, he calls it psychedelic performance art, where what we're doing is we're not only altering our own consciousness within the context of the performance, but we're trying to project something out to the audience to have the audience take something away from it, maybe even change their own mind and their own consciousness. So how do you consider that dialogue between you and the audience? What are you getting out of it? And what do you think the audience is getting out of it in a burlesque performance?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's so much things that I do, like, personally around energy work and what I project and receive from my audience. And primarily, of course, I'm there to be a performer, but everything that I do in my body of work is incredibly personal and comes based out of an experience or a feeling. And so when I work through my movement, my costuming, how things are removed, how I dance in between that, kind of like weaving spells, you know, and there's a definite give and take of energy up, down, in, out, you know, that I want to share with my audience. And I've been told that that absolutely reads, you know, and not every audience is going to get that. And that's not the purpose. It's mostly for, you know, if one or two people desire to be affected in the way that I'm projecting, I just hope that reads, you know, to them. I've been told that my work is quite healing just because of the context that I use in my personal experience. You know, I'm working through these sort of to embody these emotions for myself. So therefore, I'm pretty sure that when I'm projecting that on my audience, they're getting that as well. And it goes beyond just the whole, like, oh, there's a girl that doesn't look like she's torn out of a magazine, you know, owning her body. Like, it's above that with, you know, past experience being really traumatic or very involved, where you can make it into this sort of beautiful expression of overcoming. You know, I use that theme a lot in my work, which is like rising above and going forward and sort of tapping into your own divinity. And stage is a beautiful platform to feel and act as like a divine sort of being.
And at your burlesque center, you take on a number of students. So is that largely what you're trying to communicate to them? What do you think they're trying to get out of it? And how do those sorts of interactions progress for you and for them?
Yeah, my students are really interesting and absolutely inspiring. It's on multiple different levels. I teach drop-in classes where you might get performers and, you know, people off the street in the same class. And so those are more light and sort of fun, where anyone can come and, you know, shake their sass around and let their light out just by taking a dance class that embodies burlesque style movement, which is vivacious and incredibly powerful in its femininity all in itself. But we also give workshops, progressives, and one-on-ones. So when my students come to me usually for a one-on-one, it is because they're trying to sort of, you know, tap into something that they want to, you know, release. And sometimes they're stuck because they can't figure out why it's not translating on stage or what about their act isn't working. And usually a lot of my coaching is because I can understand they're blocked some way in their emotion or their outlet, that it's going to come out in your art. Like, you can't fake, well, you can use an archetype or a trope where you can be like, I'm just a sexy housewife and I got drunk and now my clothes are falling off. You know, that's a great archetype. I want to rock that, but usually comes off a little inauthentic and faux theatrical. Everyone knows that stereotype. So instead, you know, I encourage them to go deeper. And if they want their piece to mean something, they have to go into their own expression, which can be a process they think is just neat. I have a costume and I'm going to get naked for strangers. Ends up to be this incredibly deep, healing, personal experience where when they put it on stage, people are just very tapped into what they're trying to project. And because we're in a burlesque audience, you have this built-in innate support system where the audience, like, obviously wants you to succeed. They're there to hold you. They know that you're not just here doing a super polished dance routine. It's something more. So between the development of the student, you know, having coaching and nourishing and working on their own stuff and then putting on a stage where the audience is there with them. Like, that chemistry is a powerful sort of mix.
Do you think it's fair to call dance a form of yoga or vice versa?
That's an interesting perspective. And I can say yes, because one of my teachers, when I can't get into the studio and she's like, it's okay, burlesque is your yoga. It's become your practice and it's become the way that you take your lessons that you've learned on the mat or with yourself. And now you channel it through this. And so, of course, the concepts of yoga are the connection of breath and body, right? And about learning your deep inner truth. And so, of course, you can bend yourself into a pretzel and be breathing properly, but essentially you don't need to do any asana to be doing yoga. So sure, of course, dance can be a form of yoga.
And it's interesting that you said that maybe in some ways people start out taking dance or whatever in a sort of superficial way, or there's something aesthetic appealing because we, in Western society, everything is so much about appearances and aesthetics that that's what draws people into them. It's sort of a herd type mentality. But at the same time, sometimes that opens up doors that you didn't expect it to. So just the analogy is imperfect, but in occult practices, there's a lot of ceremonial magic, like say with the Aleister Crowley crowd or something like that.
Yeah.
And they get involved with these sort of ritualistic ceremonies. And a lot of times no one gets much out of it, but for every once in a while, someone, it just opens up this channel of the mind that they didn't really expect. It opens up this sort of mega ritual almost. And I imagine that sometimes happens with dancing or something akin to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I went to a panel. There's a thing called BurleyCon, which happens in Seattle once a year. And it's the only non-performance educational burlesque event that we have. And so we teach classes for like 4 days. You know, people from all over the world come teach classes. And we have forums and panels and peer reviews. That's the closest thing we have to a performance, is a peer review. But I went to listen to a panel called Burlesque is a Spiritual Practice. And Christine and Nakaya have brought up how the first shamans were performers. Like, you know, they were dancers and there was pageantry and costume. And of course, to channel and to bring people into that space, I think that pageantry is needed to create something that is a little bit surreal for your reality. And so that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I find burlesque to be such a deeper practice than, you know, like you say, just the superficial aesthetics of rhinestones on a bra. You know, there's so much that gets released and tapped in. And when I first started, I absolutely knew that the aesthetic was something that appealed to me, but there was more of a platform to, you know, express myself, obviously. But my first couple of numbers I loved and were meaningful, but the more I started to work with the medium and with the removal and with, again, the personal experience and sort of channeling and spell weaving, then I realized how powerful it truly can be. Whether or not, you know, your audience is fully able to accept it every time or even read it every time doesn't quite matter, because the energy and the magic is still being created regardless if every person is sort of channeling that.
So in the context of a performance or when you're preparing, obviously you put a lot of conscious effort into choreographing and what have you, but I know a lot of artists, especially writers, would say, well, after the fact, I looked at it and it almost seemed like I was actually channeling something. You mentioned the collective consciousness or collective unconscious there. So do you ever get that sense through some of your performances or in your preparatory work after the fact or during? You're like, oh, this was me, but it was not me?
Not really me or not me. Like I feel like, you know, sometimes I invoke certain goddesses or just goddess energy or even just to, you know, ask to be a conduit. Like I sort of do some of that kind of work before I go on stage, but often it's sort of, I've experienced a feeling of kind of just being so in the moment that I almost don't even know what happened. Like I know I'm going through the motions. I know things are happening, but I get off stage and I'm like, what did I just do? I've rehearsed and I've practiced and I know things went off like really well. But that's sort of when I first started, I got more of those sensations because I was just so excited. Like I say, stage chops, right? Nowadays, the consciousness is so rooted. So I feel like what I contribute to my art form is an incredible presence. Like I feel very grounded on stage and very energetic. And what my goal is to like literally pull energy like from the earth around me, project it out, pull it back in. And like, I live for that exchange. So I feel very, very much like a conduit of energy as opposed to sort of someone, something else filling me up. But there definitely is like when you're creating, you know, you can kind of feel the flow, period, and let that sort of move you. Like my choreography, because I'm not classically trained, I don't count in eights. My combinations that I put together are more about feeling as opposed to structure. And I purposefully choreograph without choreography in certain parts because I want my removals to be effortless and clean, but I also want to leave room for when you are on stage and that energy does start flowing, that I don't have to be married to my steps. Like, what if I need to go over here and interact with that person because they need a dose of this energy that I'm conjuring? Like, I want to leave room for that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's definitely those kind of feelings.
Being an artist and I guess being in that sort of state of mind more often than the usual person, I often connect the unconscious with the artistic state of mind. And the less artistic you are, the less likely you are to tap into your deeper motivations, your deeper self, whatever you want to call that. Now, in doing that, I know that a lot of folks sometimes get some high strangeness in their life. He was not necessarily an inspiration, but this graphic artist, Grant Morrison, he speaks of this thing called a hyper sigil, where he was working on his graphic novels for a long time. And in throwing himself into this work, he started attracting certain characters to himself that he was writing about, or he started experiencing synchronicity in a intense sort of way, or having some sort of out-of-body experience or some such thing. So having been an artist for so long, have you noticed you attracting those sorts of things into your life?
It's hard to say if it's always kind of been with me, like that kind of sensation. Like I have identified as being like witchy since I was little. My grandmother was psychic. I used to practice astral projection in grade six. Like I've spent time being a conjurer. And so when I finally found a platform of art that I could work through, like burlesque, it just sort of, like I say, it brought so much more to light than it did when I didn't have it. Like I felt listless and incomplete when I didn't have something to channel my work into.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, when I started to do burlesque, of course you see the world around you, other people doing the art form, and you just sort of, you know, you hope that your work speaks for itself and that your community will grow around you and that you will tap into deeper into those people that maybe you need to guide you in inspiration. Like I've looked to different people that I just sort of noticed their style that I really needed to look at how and why they did it and embody it. But I would say my life, you know, even outside of just burlesque, is always very, you know, I guess I can use the word synchronicity or serendipitous. I've always sort of had that consciousness and sort of been open to it. So it, you know, burlesque, and it's sort of, you know, it's a dreamlike place where we play dress up and, you know, get on stage. It's fabulous. But, you know, underneath all of that, there's this, the underlying thing of art and hard work. And it isn't glamour, like, you know, glamour magic, right? How it's really false and you just sort of Jedi mind trick everyone into think you're really fabulous from afar. And I think burlesque has lots of glamour magic because the blood, sweat, and tears and money and hard work that goes into it to create this small piece of work in these moments in time is pretty incredible. But yeah, I don't know. My life is luckily full of interesting, serendipitous, lovely moments.
Well, a little bird told me that you might have had an out-of-body experience once or twice. Could you retell that experience if you're willing to?
Yeah, well, I was really, like, I was just really dedicated to knowing things more occultish when I was young because I was fascinated by them and I always felt spiritual presences around me. I always just knew that the veil of the world is quite thin and always sort of wanting to tap into that. And I would go to my local library and I would look up books on astral projection or like how to read faces or, you know, just different sensitivities to kind of like look past people's masks and sort of understand them. And when I read about astral projection, I was like, okay, yeah, I understand that. Okay. There's different levels of consciousness and perfect. Okay. We'll just go on a little trip and, it's like, we'll just go there. So when I started to like do my meditation, because you look at the pictures and you read how you're supposed to kind of get out of the body and look at yourself and kind of float around your room and see a silver cord. And that was never my experience. It was more just jumping right into energetic levels. So when I went up into these sort of, I went through my roof, I definitely felt like, you know, leaving the sort of physical plane and, you know, entering energetic planes and knowing that I'm allowed to seek or feel out a guide, like a spirit presence or energetic presence to sort of help me. So I remember sort of floating around and it was very light, very white, very clean feeling, but then sort of sinking like quite quickly and feeling like different levels sort of flash before my eyes and then being in this very dark sort of space and knowing that I'm not supposed to be there. It was heavy and very much like pulling. And all I did was sort of like, I'm not supposed to be here, and kind of like noted to my guide, like just be like, I'd like to leave this place now, and being pulled back up through the light and then back into my body. And that was sort of the only sort of experiences I had when I was younger were sort of similar to that. I just sort of meditate and be, you know, floating in energetic sense without really, I never had a direction. I just wanted to be able to do it. You know, I was like, maybe I can train myself to just do this.
Yeah.
But the second time that I sort of spent any time doing it was when I was traveling in Thailand, and transcendental meditation and sort of astral projection was quite common. Well, not common, but there was this place up in Pai where I was staying where it had this center, and I'd sort of seen it at a bookstore and I was like, I should go visit this person because I used to do that when I was younger. Wonder if that's still a thing. And went to visit, had a chat, spoke in English, and you know, I just sort of had a nice talk and thought I'd go and sort of try it. The details of the conversation, like I was 19, I'm, you know, I'm much older now, and I couldn't really tell you the details of what we had talked about. It was quite blurry in my mind. But when I went back to my hut and just went into my meditation state and again, like felt the room, felt me leave the room, travel through a very energetic plane, but then very quickly drop into a body that was, I sort of describe it as like ancient Egypt. It felt like, I don't know, I was in a cog, like it was literally a wooden wheel, like being pushed together with several other slaves, super hot and it's dusty. And like, it was gnarly. And I was like, wow, I am definitely not supposed to be here either. Like, you know, it's sort of, this is not my body. This is not me. And so I'm unclear, you know, I didn't feel like a past life. It felt, you know, Misty and I were talking yesterday and she thought maybe a context of someone who might have needed my energy or something. Mm-hmm. That kind of resonated with me. But it was the same thing where I was very conscious of being there with them and then being able to take myself away and sort of pull up and back into my own body and space. And I remember being much more rattled by that one, you know, because I was older and had such a very vivid experience that I was like, ooh, maybe we just won't tap into that. Well, I'm traveling alone in the mountains of Thailand. Wow. Yeah, maybe I won't go back in time right now. So, I mean, I haven't done it for a long time, of course, only in dream states where I do find myself flying or lifting or being light and elevated. That's the only other thing I can kind of relate it to is I had an ayahuasca ceremony 2 summers ago and could definitely if we want to talk about out of body or energetic planes, but that being with medicine inside of you as opposed to self-induced. I value both, but a very different experience altogether.
Yeah. So what was the ayahuasca experience like for you? Because I have not tried it, but I've read extensively on it, and it is strangely similar between people from all over the world.
Yes, absolutely.
All kinds of different cultures and what have you. Mm-hmm. So in experiencing that, was it the archetypal? Were there snake archetypes? What did you see? What did you hear? What did you feel?
Yeah, it definitely was archetypal, and serpent energy resides deeply within me after that experience. Grandmother ayahuasca is serpent, and you know, people that I do talk to, even within the group that I did, with other groups that have done it, you know, our friends that have done it, they definitely talk about the serpent. My experience was long and vast. Like, we journeyed all through the night from about 9 until like 5 or 6 in the morning. And I definitely went through beautiful, really gorgeously vivid understanding, seeing, feeling, being part of the web of the universe, you know, the beautiful geometry, the Shiva, Shakti, like the hard, I remember like hard cogs of dark energy, like moving together, like mathematically. And it was all like pinholes of blue starlight through them, but very mathematical. And around all of this was that beautiful, like aurora borealis dancing light. And I didn't understand it until I talked to one of my yogis about it, and she was like, oh, it's totally Shiva Shakti. And I looked up some images, and of course him or the, you know, the hard is always this sort of representative, strong black mathematical, and she is always the dancing light. So that was really beautiful, because in my mind I was like, this is the web of the entire universe. How interesting. I just understood fully. But when I came out of it, of course I had to research it a little bit, because when you're in it, you understand it, and then you go back to understand it. Serpent Gateway was fascinating because I do have a snake. Her name is Nacho. She's a little corn snake, and I love her, and we adopted her, and I've always liked snakes, but would never think to go and just buy one. Who buys snakes? That's fascinating. But I was looking at this mandala while I was journeying. It's quite early in the journey, and the mandala started to rotate and move, and then it was all snakes. So there was thousands of them. And at first, of course, I felt fear. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, snakes, there's so many. And I was like, wait, I love snakes. Cool. Like, you know, it took me a second to kind of adjust to the intensity and immensity of it. And
yeah,
after watching how beautiful it was, like if you've ever watched a serpent move, you do understand the sort of beauty and strength. And then on the outside of the mandala, the big giant, like black purple snake came out, and like her face was very evident. She's coming towards me. And I was like, whoa, like she's big guns, you know. And she rolled up the side of my body. And it's interesting because when you journey, you lay down, and I could feel her coming up the side of my body. And she came up around the right side of my face and told me to open my mouth. And I was like, yes, ma'am, of course. And I opened wide, and she just poured information, light into me. I'm not even sure, like I know that it comes out in different places, her wisdom, but just filled, and my whole body stretched and moved, like almost involuntarily, like filled with whatever she was giving me. And she stayed beside me for a little bit. And I thought, one of my friends had said, don't forget to ask questions while you're journeying. I'm like, oh, this must be the time. And I was like, grandmother, I have questions. Is this what we're supposed to do it? And she like, of course, this didn't happen, but in a modern context, just looked at me. She's like, bitch, please, like, pay attention. This is not what this is about. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I understand. I'm going on this journey. I'm not here to ask specifics. I'm being here to be shown and to dip my feet into pools that are deep and run dark. And so that was, you know, interesting. And we stayed together for a little bit, and then the journey sort of change as it comes in these crazy waves. I could feel her the whole time. And I know that when things got quite crazy, because they were mostly beautiful and very interesting, but I went to some places where I definitely needed the healing, and they run dark and deep. And sometimes I'd just reach out with my energy and be like, are you still here? And she would say yes, but I never saw her again through the journey. Other crazy things, but definitely she's present.
It's interesting you call it mathematical. Was that just a sense, or did you see numerical? What triggered that?
I saw no numbers, but in the geometry, I just understand that it is math. I'm adorned with tattoos that are, you know, triangle, circle, square. I know that they can be divided into infinity together mathematically, but the mathematical sense is like my belief that everything is made of science and magic. It's sort of just my philosophy of life. So when I felt the geometry and when I felt the structure, I equate structure to math and sort of equate the loose dancing light energy to magic.
Yeah. And the reason I ask was for a while, I had very little appreciation for math. And when people would talk about how everything was math and math was the language of the universe, I would raise my eyebrows and roll my eyes and ask further questions. And I still do that because I still think these things get fetishized. But at the same time, math fundamentally, when you look at it on paper, it's these compartmentalized, segregated bits getting added up to equate to something. But by and large, the study of math is a study of relationships.
Right.
And if you want to say that the universe is mathematical, well, yeah, it's based on relationships. Everything defines itself in relation to something else. It is that web of life or that web of light or whatever else you want to refer to it as. And so in that sense, yes, it is totally mathematical and it is totally mystical at the same time. So there's this rationality and irrationality that coincide with one another and run parallel and sync up in these amazing ways.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. I agree 100%. And I'm terrible at math. So I respect and love numbers, but I don't do them. I'm on the magic side. But I appreciate when people can be like, watch me turn your magic into an equation. I'm like, neat. Anyway, back to the light. So I always like joke how I don't do math unless I'm counting money. Yeah.
Two things. It's interesting that the cog wheel or the circle cropped up in both your out of body and your ayahuasca, because the monad or the circle is the embodiment of unity.
Mm.
It's a symbol that crops up in every sort of mystery tradition from alchemy to Hinduism. So you getting that as a major theme is no surprise to me.
Mm.
But at the same time, my question to you is, what do you think the utility of these are? What have you gotten out of them, or what do you think people can get out of, I guess, getting in touch with this quote unquote irrational side of themselves or the unconscious or any of these things or their artistic side? Because I don't know, day to day life is about survival and making money and just making sure your status is in place. Mm. But art and the unconscious open up all these other vistas. So what would be your, if someone's flirting with the idea, why should they do it or what could they get out of it?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, through our daily of, you know, our mortal coil, if you put it that way, is like we forget that we're one and we forget that we're connected and we forget our own divinity and our own light. And so, of course, through art, through medicine, through meditation, we reconnect with each other and, you know, reconnect with ourselves. And I think that, you know, that magic isn't taught to us in day-to-day life. It's, you know, it's forced down our throat to be this sort of consumeristic thing in a society. And when we tap back into those places, we remember, you know, it's like soft, beautiful whispers being like, you are beautiful. You are one. You are light. And when we see it in ourselves, then we see it in each other. You know, we don't have to feel that struggle or feel that sense of aloneness. And it's kind of a paradox because I really like being alone, but I also really like being connected, you know, in the sense where you can tap into the fact that we're all made of stardust. And that's something that we don't get when we're just shopping at the grocery store all the time. So we need to take these moments and go back into our beautiful, magical places to remember and connect.
Now, you have some familiarity with tarot, yes?
Yeah.
So a similar question. What do you think of the utility is of that? I mean, my read on it is that it's largely an aesthetic meditative tool that lets you clear your mind when, I guess, trying to look into your unconscious or your subconscious. And in those instances, I think that people are actually looking to themselves for guidance and not so much the cards, but they trick themselves into thinking the cards are telling them something when in fact themselves are telling them something. Mm-hmm. So how long have you been making use of those and why do you use them?
Yeah, I love tarot, and it's exactly for what you said. Any divination practice, runes, tea leaves, you know, tarot, is absolutely a place to stay still and focus the mind on things that you're questioning. I love using them because I love imagery. I love symbology. And when you can sit with your cards and look into their symbols that you can put in your own context, I think it's a beautiful meditative practice. And, you know, I use them for inspiration. I use them for tapping in. I sometimes look to the cards to be like, I am really contemplating this, but I am also a firm believer that you already have all the answers and you're just not either ready to see them or ready to tap in. They're already there. Mm-hmm. People always come to me with their, you know, because I'm a teacher and a healer, when people come to me and they're like, I just don't know. I'm like, but you do, you know, it's quite simply, you absolutely do, but you're not ready. And that's okay. If you need to think on it more, you need to torture yourself or contemplate, then please do, but know that everything's already inside of you to be discovered. And things like divination and tarot are just a really beautiful way to put and embody some of those archetypes that we need to have. You know, sometimes I really need to be reminded, you know, of my magician energy, or I really need to be reminded that there are forces out there that aren't working with me and I need to not have them in my life because they're not serving me, you know. So I think it's a beautiful tool.
And getting back to what you said much earlier in our conversation, but you said that you got in touch with the rave scene and that was maybe something that opened up your eyes to dancing. And I don't pay much attention to the club kid scene or anything, but from my read of it, it is clearly a effort of the Western mind to try to reclaim something that's been lost. And so I don't necessarily advocate that we all return to living in the jungle and drinking ayahuasca day to day. I mean, I don't think everything's wrong about Western culture, but at the same time, in the progression and the technological dystopia that we built, we've definitely lost some sort of like wisdom traditions and just sort of sense of centering ourselves. And the rave scene or the club kid scene is really an effort by these sorts of folks to reclaim something that's been lost. And even something like tarot or astrology or synchronicity, it's study of these things. There's an irrational side to people, and that's not a disparate term, I don't think. I'd like to co-opt it and make that something that people can be proud to say, yeah, I'm irrational, but it's actually helping me lead a healthier, more fulfilling life. It's not turning me into some sort of dogmatic, theocratic asshole. In fact, it's actually making me warmer and it's helping me out.
Yeah.
And I think all these things are ways that actually can help. And I just think we're embedded in a culture that tells you that these are wrong or they're taboo. And people moving towards them or trying to reclaim them is actually the next evolution of human thought. It's integration. We're always trying to integrate new things, and it's important to get in touch with those if you feel it's right. I just think a lot of people sense that taboo, and because we're herd animals, we don't want to be excommunicated from the herd. So we say, okay, I'm not going to ever explore that. Mm-hmm. But a repressed life is no life at all.
100%. And it's something that, you know, people think is taboo. I mean, it's such a Darwinism, like they want to separate and compartmentalize and judge. We're not taught how to come together and connect. You know, we have to take that on ourselves, you know, remember to connect, remember we're one, instead of casting everybody else out. And to touch on the rave, you know, kind of community, I do it less now because, like most things in your life, they serve a deep purpose, you know, especially if you do it intentionally. And when I first started raving, it was a place where I could go for 12 hours and dance. Like, are you kidding me? Where does that even exist in the world? It was amazing. And like, people would just, they don't have to dance with each other. There was like a consistent beat. It was like, it was trance. It's transcendental, right? And people just get into these, well, personally, I would just get into these meditative states where things were just like beautiful. I had my first biggest epiphanies of oneness, of wholeness, of divinity while on the dance floor at a rave, you know, all by myself. And I would just go to these places of feeling like so beautiful and so connected and sort of accepting my own beauty, and open my eyes. And there's just a circle of people around me watching because I was just dancing those emotions, dancing those feelings, and being conscious of it, but not really conscious of it because I was too busy playing in these energy fields. And that to me, I was just like, oh, there's something deeper than just coming to a party and doing drugs and having a DJ. There is some really deep work, you know, going on if you were able to tap into it. And I think that's dance culture. I've always related to that. And I always think society suffers when we don't have a dance culture to tap into. Like, you know, you can't just go out all the time to a top 40 bar and like drink vodka Red Bulls and have an epiphany. That kind of culture is not, you know, where you go, but it is around music and it is around dance, but there's a disconnect, that separation where it's more about the going out clubbing as opposed to going to a party and being with like-minded people and having a safe space to explore these other realms, quite literally.
Yeah. And these things have, they have a superficial side and they have a very deep mystical side. So even something like LSD, which nowadays has become more of a, say, club drug or just a party drug, back in the 60s, 70s, it was part of spiritual practice. Love or hate, some of the context it was done in or some of the goofy messages that were coming out of the era, at its core, it was a spiritual practice. It was meant to facilitate personal growth. And I think so many of these things, when you mingle them with a very superficial Western culture, yeah, they're going to become club drugs or they're going to become these sort of superficial, let me just blow off some steam for a night and then forget about it and just go on with my repressed or frustrated life. But when people take a very deliberate and attentive approach to them, they can help facilitate healing, or you don't always need to go to a therapist. There's some things you can do to take your own power back and use these things as tools, dance, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So we're getting pretty close to an hour. So I guess in getting close to wrapping up, why don't you let us know what's on the horizon for you, the Burlesque Hall of Fame and what have you?
Yeah, the next part of my year is really exciting, and I feel in a place where I've put in some work and some bookings are coming my way, which are really fascinating. And I get to travel for my work, which is amazing. I just got word that I'll be headlining the Stockholm Burlesque Festival. So I get to go to Europe this fall and do Germany and Sweden and possibly France, maybe even Finland, depending on sort of where the other bookings line up. And to me, you know, I haven't been to Europe. I've been to Asia, and that's a pretty exciting thing to be brought over for. Lots of stuff, even just in the States. I'm going to the Hall of Fame, but first I stop in Phoenix, then I hop over to Vegas, and then over to Chicago, which will be amazing. And of course, this summer is the Bass Coast Festival, which I'm sure you'd appreciate is definitely a small 4,000 people, July 10, 11, 12, I believe. And you know, it's on a river. It's all really intentional community. The music that's chosen, the art projects that are chosen, it has classes and yoga and cooking. And it's quite a magical place to go into, especially because people show up there to be intentional and kind of be a community, along with, of course, partying as much or as little as you want. So we get to perform there again this year, and that's really great. And then another thing that's very unwork related, but I'm going to Costa Rica with my flapper in crime, Rita Starr, and we're going to get beachy for no reason. We're just going to not work, which seems crazy. But to me, it's also exciting because I believe in self-care. It's very necessary for the full-time hustler to tap out and go listen to the waves.
Lola, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you too, John. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.